Listener Production.
Hey, it's Antoinette Latouf with the Weekend Briefing. So, Ziggy Ramo and I first met on the set of Q&A about 5 years ago. And from memory, it was me and him and Barnaby Joyce and, yeah, interesting trio. So he is a Wick and South Sea Islander man. He was in his early 20s at the time. And I remember just being taken by his ability to be in a room like that, because it's usually, you know, politician and seasoned broadcasters, it's live TV, and his insights and his passion that he brought to the conversation was just so darn impressive. And as it turns out, he'd already written his first album, but that wouldn't be released for years because at the time the world wasn't quite ready to embrace Ziggy's art and his perspective. He was a powerful storyteller and rapper from his teenage years, and it was after the Black Lives Matter movement gained global attention that he set his words into the world. He's now written a book. It's his memoir, Human, with a question mark, and I have so many questions for Ziggy, which we'll get to in a moment. Later in the show, you'll hear from Helen Smith, who joins me for the Weekend List, with a bunch of cool recommendations for you. But first, here's my chat with Ziggy Ramo. Ziggy Ramo, welcome to the Weekend Briefing.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to start at the very beginning. And every time I say that, it makes me think of The Sound of Music in that song. Because it is a good place. It is a good place to start. Tell me about your family and your great-grandmother and, you know, how that impacted you.
I mean, well, 3% of Australians kind of have an understanding of my lived experience in that, you know, there aren't that many of us today. And so I was going to say I had a pretty specific childhood in that being part of the 3% and then that father being university educated and a principal, and it gave me a real opportunity to learn and be curious and inquisitive about what's gone on in the last 236 years. And then, you know, very strong, supportive, beautiful mother who instilled in us to just always try our hardest and try our best. I think that all kind of simmered down into me and who I am. And I think, you know, we're all shaped by our families and the important people around us. And I mean, I wear all of that pretty strongly on me. I wouldn't be who I am without that.
And your great-grandmother, she was stolen from her family. Did you ever meet her? And also your great-grandfather, he was blackbirded, kidnapped and enslaved. Did you have the fortune of meeting them?
Yeah, no. No, I didn't. Not firsthand. But I mean, they've played such a big part in my life through, I would say, like, their strength and their courage and those stories being passed down. So, you know, without a physical meeting, I still feel like I had the privilege of having them play a very big role in my life.
And obviously telling stories and communicating is something you're incredibly passionate about. And you started rapping quite young. Who inspired that, or, you know, who were your idols at that time?
Yeah, I mean, like, weirdly, my brother was such a big part in that. He was 6 years older than me and very obsessed with music. And so he was kind of showing me what was cool. And him being my big brother was very, it was like a really big bonding thing. And so when I kind of stumbled into figuring out that I had a passion for music, he was kind of my tastemaker. So he was picking all of the real, I guess, first albums that influenced me, from Mos Def to Lauryn Hill to Kanye West to, you know. But then it was my parents were really interested in music as well, so we had a very eclectic kind of catalogue and discographies being played in the house, from Archie Roach to Stevie Wonder to, yeah, it was pretty far and diverse, which I think, yeah, played a very big part in it.
Well, you mentioned Lauryn Hill, and I did love the Like A Virgin you did with Christine Arnoux, and we're just going to play a little snippet.
Since you've been looking for your friend, the one you let it hit and never call you again. Remember when he told you he was about the Benjamins? You act like you ain't him and give him a little trim to begin.
What was going through your mind when you were giving that a 2023 treatment of such an iconic 90s hit?
That album, The Miseducation of Lauryn Hill, was played in our house weekly. You know, that was the days of CD players still. So every kind of Sunday house cleaning, that album was just, in constant rotation. And I don't know if you've had this feeling or experience, but art that has like nostalgia attached to it that you keep returning to, like, can change meaning over time as you change. And this song that I just used to love because of the melodies and the flow and cadence, as I got older and older, like, the messages started to take on different shapes and I started to understand them in different ways as well. And so I think when I was doing Like A Virgin, I came back to that song and, because when you cover a song, you kind of get on into the fabric of the DNA of it and explore it in a different way. For me, it was just trying to honor something that I love so much and then trying to bring my artistry to it as well.
You had an album that was written and recorded and you hung on to it for a while before releasing it. And that was a strategic move on your part. Why did you do that?
Hindsight probably makes it feel more strategic than, like, in reality. I was like 20 and had this album about, like, systemic oppression and the dense history of colonization in our country. And so when I was walking into label meetings, no one was really jumping up and down being like, oh my God, this is...
You're like, Gary, Steve, I don't get it. Why don't you want this album?
Well, I write about this in the book. There was a big sound that I played this album at with a 6-piece band. One of the heads of a label said, it's so confusing because you're doing hip hop, but you've got live musicians. And I just don't understand why you're so angry. And that was kind of the sentiment of what was going on when I came in with that album. And I think there was a lot of people that understood the art of it, but they didn't understand where it fit and how it fit. And as a young emerging artist at that point, it was really difficult because it's like the music business. And so, like, I had spent the large majority of my early career just learning the music side of things and my artistry, and then there was this whole other side of, like, you make it and then you have to find out how to put it out and what it is to kind of turn it into, you know, like, getting an ABN and paying taxes and, like, paying yourself super because you're self-employed and there's, like, no safety net.
So what year was this when you had it and couldn't find a home for it?
Yeah, so I wrote it in the end of 2015, start of 2016, and then I had put out 3 songs as an EP from that album, and with the plan, because I wanted to turn that album into a book, because that album is 7,000 words, which is very lyrically dense for a body of music. And there was so much history and context that I wanted to unpack. And so I have these kind of cold call emails from, like, 2016, 2017 of me being like, hey, I've got this album and I want to make it into a book and it's my debut. What do you reckon? And it didn't really transpire. I kind of... that being in 2015, 2016, and me being very clear in what I was trying to do, it somewhat put me on the outer where I just had time and space to really learn who I was and what was important to me. And so then I held on to that album, performing it over the years. And then in 2020, with the murder of George Floyd, the world and Australia started having a conversation about Black Lives Matter. And it was a very interesting thing because at the time it felt like, and from our leaders, there was a sentiment of like, let's not make American problems Australian issues. And that was a really interesting thing to hear.
Sorry, I didn't mean to laugh. That was more.
Oh, no, yeah.
That was more a scoff at like, oh, these things just are so far away and we can't understand, comprehend how they would happen here.
Yeah, totally. And that was, you know, Scott Morrison had recently also proclaimed that Australia didn't have slavery and, you know, and all of that stuff was in direct contradiction to my understanding through what I had lived. And so it felt like, you know, as everyone was either saying that they mattered or trying to distance themselves from it, it felt like we needed to have the conversation within our context. And I felt like I had this kind of 4 or 5 year old album that was doing that. And it just felt like, well, there's no point in waiting anymore for a label executive to understand what I'm trying to do. I just have to do it. So then I released it independently and got on with it.
Yeah, great. And how was it received by audiences? Were audiences now ready to hear your music and to hear your pain and journey?
It's been a really interesting thing because it's not that in 2015 that there weren't people ready to hear it. It was just as an industry and as an artist who thought I needed the industry to support and understand me, it was really hard to put in a box. Like, because as well, right, like the reason why we're sitting down and having this interview is because I've written a book, which is also an album, which is also an art exhibition. As artists, like, I think our role is to stay honest and transparent and try and get to, telling these true things regardless of the medium. And that was not really something that was very understood when I came in. But there was always, from an audience perspective, from the moment I was telling things that were honest to me, I think there was always people that found like reciprocated and could connect to the authenticity of what I was telling. In a specific question, like I think 2020, there was a more willingness to engage with it because we'd all went out there and publicly said that Black Lives Matter. Well, then, okay, well, then we got to make good on that and look at our own backyard before we start kind of, you know, waving fingers at overseas.
So you've written this book, Human, with a question mark.
Yeah.
What's with the question mark?
Doing Black Thoughts, that debut album, and getting to have lots of conversations around it, I started to realise that there's a really big gap in our understanding because of lived experience. And so when you have, when something is in your sphere and it's affecting you, you are just so much more curious to understand it and learn about it because it feels very present for you and for a lot of, well, for the vast majority of Australians, what has been affecting our community has been very purposefully separated and protected from them having to grapple with, because when we started colonizing these countries 236 years ago, it was on the founding principle that some people were human and other people weren't, because that is literally in the documentation of Terra Nullius, which grew from the doctrine of discovery. And the whole principle is that it doesn't deny that we weren't here, it denies that we were human, because humans had ownership and non-humans had occupancy. And so the whole point of the question mark is I don't think we've ever reckoned with the fact that the only way colonization and the scope of European colonization is just like it is the fabric of the world. You know, it's I write about this in the book of how far reaching it is. So these kind of founding tenets of dehumanization is in our current, it is what our current systems rely on. And my whole idea is to try and bring us to the root versus the symptoms, because the symptoms within our community is, high rates and disproportionate rates of incarceration, or youth suicide, or gaps in life expectancy, low education outcomes. Like, they're all the symptoms of being dehumanized, but then we focus on the symptoms, but we don't focus on the root cause. So then new symptoms just appear, because when you continually dehumanize a group of people, it doesn't matter if they kill themselves young, or they die because they have bad health outcomes, or they get locked up and get killed in custody. Like, there will always be a symptom that will manifest itself when you have been dehumanized for 236 years.
So what do you think needs to happen for, as you say, the 3%, and we're going to get to terminology in just a moment, for the 3% to be seen as human?
This whole work is actually more of an invitation, in that I think that when you dehumanize people, you in turn lose your own humanity. And I think it's not so much about, you know, learning and becoming an expert in our history. I think it's more about, like, becoming an expert in what you already know, because innately we are compassionate and empathetic as humans, because we're a social species and we depend and rely on connection to each other. And I think it's actually just taking away the smoke and mirrors and our biases of who we see worthy of being human, and starting to actually just acknowledge that we're all human. And until we can acknowledge that, I think we will just keep hurting each other.
In your book, you decided to use the word original peoples, and that's in lieu of Aboriginal, Indigenous, First Nations, Native, etc. Why did you make that decision? What does language in this context and those words mean to you?
Yeah, so in the same way of the question mark, right, it's all just intentional to try and help people think. Because I think I've tried to be careful within this book, is I'm not telling you what you have to take from it. This is just an exercise in understanding and trying to share, in that you've probably, the vast majority of people, never questioned, why do we call Aboriginal people Aboriginal? Like, when Aboriginal people are, 500 nations with 700 dialects with different countries, like, this language and terminology was never ours. It was used and put upon us from the people who committed genocide against us. And for me, I'm a Wik man, and, like, that is my terminology. I am Wik. And Aboriginal is a Latin word, ab meaning of, and original of original or beginning. So it was a Latin word. Latin is Roman Catholic. Roman Catholic created Doctrine of Discovery, which grew into Terra Nullius, which was the justification of our genocide. So for me, it's not really a word that I find is me. Like, it's a word that has been used to homogenize us and make us singular, when we're actually very individual and different. Look, it's not an expectation that everyone else has to use that word, but in my art, in my space where I am going to be talking and unpacking these things, I just want to be honest. And it's like, I don't feel, especially when you get into, like, when you start looking into, like, the 1905 Aborigines Act and this and that, like, all of the racist legislation and discriminative policy that has been used under the guise of protecting and serving Aboriginality, I just really struggle with.
And on that topic of words, what some people are struggling with at the moment is acknowledgement of country, feeling disingenuous, or feeling like something that has to be done at the start of every, you know, Zoom meeting and every in so many different spaces. How do you feel about where we're up to in terms of that acknowledgement of country? If it comes with the sense that it's, you know, half the room is rolling their eyes and other people are doing it because they're told they have to.
So I'm not really concerned with what the room's doing. I'm concerned with the person giving it, because you can't control how people respond to what you say, whether that's an acknowledgement to country, whether that's whatever it is, you know. In my personal opinion, an acknowledgement doesn't have to be the one that everyone writes. Like, I think it should be a deeply personal reflection, because if you are making an acknowledgement of country, I think it has to come with a certain reverence. I write in the book that I think it should be, it should come with more of the weight of like a minute silence, in that it is a deep state of reflection where you are taking a moment to hold space to understand what has happened on the country you stand on. Like, pay respects to elders past and present. Like, what are you paying respect about? If you have the opportunity to deliver an acknowledgement, just take a moment to reflect on what you individually are acknowledging, and even take it one step further and understand what country you're on. And, like, you know, like how it would be like, and I write about this in the book as well, is in that, like, we understand Europe as a very diverse culturally place. So if you were doing a thank you for having me here and you are in Sweden, or if you were in Greece, the way in which you would talk about those two places would be completely different. And I think acknowledgements of country should be specific and tailored to the country you are acknowledging.
I'm curious to know what part, be it a chapter or a couple of pages of your book that you're most proud of, that when you read over, you're like, damn, I'm good. I really like this part. Is there something that you're especially proud of?
That's so funny. I just have recorded the audiobook, so it's all like very fresh in my head. Basically, the last thing I wrote is probably the thing I'm most proud of. I was making an amendment in chapter 8 called Shame, and I wrote about the experience of taking Aunty Kayleen, who I worked with on a TV show, back to Tenor Island in Vanuatu, where her great grandfather was stolen from. He was a chief from Tenor Island, and I had the privilege of kind of really rallying to take her and go home for the first time and hear the stories of her family and Chief Jeffrey on Tenor Island, who's a paramount chief who allowed us to record songs about blackbirding. And like, that specific experience was so special, but also just like, that last piece of writing, I had been editing the book for months at that point, and actually getting the inspiration to write again and feel like, oh, I've learned how to write a book, because like I when I wrote that section, it came out edited, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So there was like it was a real proud feeling of just like, oh, I actually learnt how to write a book by writing a book. So that was really cool.
That was Ziggy Ramo, a Wick man, author, rapper, all-round legend. And you can check out his book Humans, which is available in all good bookstores. And if you're in Melbourne or heading to the Melbourne Writers Festival, you can catch him on stage on May 10 and May 11th. I'm now joined by producer extraordinaire Helen Smith, because it's time for the weekend list, and that is where we pretty much share what we've been reading and watching and listening to, and we tell you if we love it and we tell you if we think you two should try it. So, Helen, what is your tip this week?
So my first recommendation is a recipe. It's a pasta salad, and like a cold pasta salad. Mm-hmm. But the thing that I love the most from this is the sauce, the dressing that I made. So it's Greek yogurt, pesto, yeah, honey, and a little bit of lime, I think, or you can do lemon, but I put lime. And it honestly goes with everything. I've put it with this pasta salad. I put it with carrot fries. I love making carrot fries. And it's super easy. You don't use too much of your pesto as well. So you can like keep using a jar for a while.
And it's healthy.
It's healthy. And you know exactly what's going into that dressing. Mm. And like me, I'm lactose intolerant. So I can use lactose-free Greek yogurt. So I can customize to my IBS.
And did you just make that recipe up?
I found it on TikTok.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah. So it's by this nutritionist. She's actually based in the UK. Her name is Emily English.
Okay.
So, yeah, check her out. She's got great recipes on there.
Very good. Okay, so my first recommendation is a book, a new book out by Louise Milligan. So it's actually her debut crime thriller, and she is the ABC investigative journalist who does lots of the, you know, really saucy, juicy stuff on Four Corners. And it's about a kidnapping, who becomes a hostage, who's a crime journalist. So it has all the intel of somebody who understands the media and crimes against women. And I know this might seem like a strange time to be talking, given how you've given all the rallies about crimes against women. She writes beautifully, and it tracks the wave of emotions that both the kidnapped journalist goes through and those who seek to find her. Anyway, I think it's a really good read. I would even say, despite the subject matter, it's light-ish because there's still humour in it. And I guess it is fiction. And so even though it probably draws on real events and things we know that we've both covered in the news. I don't know. I just found it really easy to read, well written. I like to get behind Aussie authors. It's called Pheasant's Nest, and it's by Louise Milligan.
Great. I like that one. I love a crime, anything really. My next recommendation is kind of to do with crime as well, actually. It's Baby Reindeer on Netflix.
Yeah, I've seen that come up, but I've no idea what it's
everywhere.
About.
Everywhere. So it's a Netflix TV series based on a comedian and his stalker. So the thing that I found really fascinating is the actor who's playing the main guy, it's his real story, and he was the comedian. So it's his real story of being stalked. And it does sound quite confronting. It is a bit creepy, but the way that it's done is really
What's the whole reindeer reference?
She calls him Baby Reindeer, and you'll find out why in the series. But yeah, he's a Scottish actor, a Scottish comedian, and it really journeys his whole life, how he got into this situation and what kind of happens at the end.
Is it funny?
Some parts are funny.
Okay.
But it kind of keeps you on the edge.
Okay.
It's not a horror though. It's a thriller.
It's a thriller.
I got a little bit scared, but still recommended it. Like, yeah, it's really interesting going into the whole, I don't know.
Dark and disturbing and twisted mind.
Yeah.
Okay, look at that. Okay, so you've got a thriller TV series. I've got a thriller kind of crime book. We're all over the light and fluffy stuff today. My second recommendation is a podcast called I Forgot to Tell You Something. And disclosure, my friend is one of the co-hosts. What I enjoy about the podcast so much is it's about living with ADHD or navigating life with ADHD. So she was diagnosed with ADHD as an adult, and it was only after supporting her son in getting a diagnosis and helping him adjust his lifestyle did she realize he's living with things that I have lived with for so long. So it traverses, I guess, parenting with ADHD and being a woman who presents, you know, ADHD symptoms often present differently. So she's now become an ADHD coach. Her co-host is an American man who also lives with ADHD and is an ADHD coach. And when they first told me like an ADHD coach, I was like, what is that? Do you help people get ADHD?
Yeah.
Or like get really strong ADHD?
Yeah.
But no, it's about navigating relationships and life and work. As someone with ADHD, I'm learning so much about her, about other people in my life who are neurodiverse. And so, yeah, it's just a really fascinating podcast because I don't have a huge amount of knowledge about ADHD, let alone how adults navigate it. Anyway, super interesting. I Forgot to Tell You Something podcast, and you can check that out wherever you get your podcasts from.
I like that. I find a lot of parents find out they have ADHD when their children have it.
Yes.
So I find that's really common, especially in women because of all the masking symptoms that women have, and the research hasn't actually been done on women because it's so hard to find.
Yep.
those symptoms.
So, it's exactly that. Plus,
I love that.
Kind of everything else that life throws at you. Do check that out. Thanks so much, Helen. That's it from me. Thank you so much for being with us and for tuning in. It is always a pleasure hanging out with you. If you want more of the Weekend Briefing, Tom Tilley will be in your ears tomorrow. You can also find us on the Listener app. You can download the Listener app in the App Store. Follow us there. Otherwise, you can follow or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts from. And why not give us a rating and a review for this interview with Ziggy Ramo? And if you're feeling super generous, why not review and rate every episode? Listener.